Thanks for listening to Pod of Jake. I'm Jake. You can reach me anytime by emailing jake@blogofjake.com. I'm fortunate to have some sponsors supporting the show whose products I genuinely love and recommend. I'll start with a word on those so the rest of the episode will have no interruptions. I hope you enjoy. This episode is brought to you by Levels. Levels uses continuous glucose monitoring to track your blood sugar in real time. It allows me to see the impact that everything I do has on my metabolic health so that I can optimize my diet and exercise accordingly. Wearing the Levels patch, I feel like I'm living in the future. There's this moment when you raise your phone to the back of your arm, it vibrates and shows your glucose level right on the screen. It's this instantaneous look inside yourself, an in-the-moment snapshot of what's going on inside your body. And while it's only showing one simple measurement for now, it's enough for me to see the future. And that's exciting. It's exciting because I believe that we can live meaningfully longer and healthier lives than we do today, and I believe technologies like Levels will help us to get there. Levels is currently running an exclusive beta program with a waitlist of over 100,000 people, but you can skip the line and join Levels today by using my link in the show notes, levels.link/Jake. Again, that's levels.link/Jake. This episode is brought to you by Aura. That's Oura. The Oura Ring, from my perspective, is the single best wearable on the market. I use it to measure my sleep, activity, and readiness on a daily basis. I bought my Oura Ring several months ago before talking with the company's CEO on the podcast. I haven't taken it off since. I believe what gets measured gets managed. So if you care at all about your health, which you should, you have to measure your sleep in order to manage it. Oura measures much more than just my time in bed. It tracks my REM sleep versus deep sleep, my resting heart rate and heart rate variability, my temperature, my activity, and much, much more. For $299, you can get your own Oura Ring on auraring.com. That's auraring.com. Auraring.com. Okay, let's get into it. Thank you very much, Eric, for joining me on the show today. It's a real pleasure to have you on. I've been into longevity for a while, as the podcast suggests, and being that you're president and CEO of the Buck Institute, you're someone that's been at the top of my list to have on the podcast for a while now, so it's great to have you. For those who aren't so familiar with you or with the Buck Institute, I think the best place to get started would be to bring everyone up to speed on your story. And as I often ask my guests, it'd be great if you could sort of start off as early as you're willing to start and bring us forward to where you are and what you're doing today.
Well, thanks for having me, Jake. I think it's great. And thank you also for all what you're doing for our field. I think we are in a truly exciting field of research with enormous implications for medicine and humankind. And I think it's always great to hear people being excited about what we do. So you asked me, you know, to give a little bit of sort of personal color in terms of how did I get into this field. Well, I've always wanted to be a scientist, and that started, you know, really small at age 8, just having been offered a microscope as a kid. It just opened my eyes to a world that was different from what anything I had ever seen. And just from that one day, even though I didn't really understand what it was to be a scientist, that's all I was thinking about doing. And I took a slightly unusual route, which was to go through medical school. And this was on the advice of a family friend who thought, you know, this will give you a different look at biology, and you can do biomedical research. And so this is what I did. I trained in Belgium, where I'm originally from, and then came for, after my MD and some clinical training, came to Boston for a postdoc with Ron Kahn at the Joslin Clinic at Harvard. And then essentially continued my career, you know, been hopping from institution to institution. I worked at NIH, I worked at University of Brussels, I worked in New York, and eventually made my way through the West Coast and to the Buck Institute, where I've been for the last 5 years as the president and the CEO, and I also run a lab here. Now, I mean, another aspect of how did I get into aging research is kind of a mixture of both serendipity and just, you know, how life goes. We ended up cloning a family of protein called histone deacetylases, and also a family of proteins that had been shown to be involved in aging, the so-called sirtuins. And my lab had worked for the last 30 years on epigenetic regulation of transcription. And so it turns out now epigenetics is one of the major regulators of the aging process. And I hope we'll come back to this later. So that was the serendipity from the scientific point of view. From a more personal point of view, I watched my dad smoking his whole life, and eventually, you know, by the time he was in his early 60s, suffer from the complications of smoking, which really showed me, you know, what he and many other people his age were living through. That is, you know, people working through their whole lives and getting to the point of 60 and being actually chronically ill for until he passed at 77. And so that really sort of painted for me an image of aging, which was somewhat atrocious, this idea that you work your whole life and you end up spending your retirement years, you know, being sick or going from hospital to hospital. And my dad is a chronic smoker, went through every single complication of smoking, cancer and bladder cancer, lung cancer, and multiple heart attacks and so on. So that really sort of made me want to combine my two interests, which is basic medical research, but also really changing the way we deliver care. And I hope we can spend some time about what I think are the shortfalls of medicine as we practice it today, and what does the field of aging actually bring to this field. Anyway, so this was a very long-winded answer to your first question. I hope that makes a lot of sense.
No, yeah, that's great. And it's great to hear sort of the professional career path and trajectory combined with the personal story and you know, family-related motivations. It all ties together to make quite a bit of sense. Why don't we start where you sort of ended up there before we get too deep into Buck and aging and everything like that. We'll start from like the most macro view possible, just talking about healthcare in general. I think a lot of people sort of fashionable to call it sick care these days because it's so reactive and responsive versus proactive and preventative. And I think there's this hope sort of underlying the longevity and aging research that, you know, at the very least, this can give us a different perspective on how we handle human health. And maybe it doesn't translate to meaningful health span extension in the immediate future, but at least we start to treat things differently. Is this just a narrative, or are you starting to see certain signs of you know, various catalysts that we're actually beginning to look at healthcare from a very macro lens, like in a very different way than we have in the past?
No, I think it is a reality, and the fact that really our current model of healthcare has shown its limitation, in that we are spending more and more, and our lifespan is not increasing in proportion. And I mean, to be honest, with your viewers or your listeners, we are spending way more than many other countries, and our actual populations is not living longer, it's actually living shorter. So we have somewhat of a deficit when you compare us to many of the countries of the Western world, and even frankly, of the non-Western world. Someone, a colleague reminded me recently that Cuba spends about a 16th of our healthcare expenditure. And despite this, they live about 3 or 4 years longer than us. And one of the biggest differences between the healthcare system in Cuba and here is that they invest almost everything into preventative medicine. And we invest half of our dollars, actually, of healthcare in the last year of life of people. So that really paints a very different picture of everything that we could do with our resources. So there are really two aspects to me of our healthcare system that are really in need of revision and challenge, to be frank. And this is a role that I think we relish playing. I really consider the field of aging as a disruptive force. And our goal is nothing but really changing the way we think about medicine and delivering care. So I see two biggest problems are, one is the fact that medicine today really considers you healthy until you have a catastrophic event. For example, you can be considered in good health, maybe not super fit, but in good health, and die from a heart attack. So the same thing, you can be considered healthy and have a cancer that will kill you within 2 or 3 years. Clearly, we know today from our work and the work of many other colleagues that the heart attack or the cancer is the epitome, is the sort of the last step of a process that's been taking place for a long time. And so we are very good at treating the acute event, you know, preventing you from dying from a heart attack or treating your cancer. And we see, you know, huge amount of progress in those two areas in the last few years, but we see very little focus on understanding what are the processes that have actually eventually led to the heart attack or the cancer, and could we have intervened way earlier to actually prevent those. So that's really one of the focus that we need to change, and that's essentially preventative medicine. The problem about preventative medicine is, what are you focusing on? How do you identify those risk factors that are actually going to make you more prone to have cancer or a heart attack? We have some evidence, but we also know that aging is the biggest risk factor, not only for cancer, for heart attack, but also for Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's, macular degeneration, osteoarthritis, osteoporosis, chronic pulmonary disease, renal failure. So there's a whole series of diseases for which aging is really the biggest risk factor. And so what the field is bringing to the table is, if you understand a risk factor, then you can hopefully try to mitigate it. And this is what we are working on. So that's the first aspect, this idea of changing medicine from reactive to proactive. And the second one is, you know, for the past 40 years, we have been, I say we, this is the whole field of biomedical research, we have been mapping intracellular pathways that control aging and that control essentially every function. And out of this has come an understanding, which is now changing the way we think about a human body or human biology. If you think about it, much of medicine and the funding system, the NIH, are based on an understanding of human biology, which dates back to the 16th century, which is essentially, you know, when people started conducting dissection of human cadavers and were able to identify the heart and the liver and all the different organs, medicine basically was based, and is still today, based on organ a manifestation. So you go see a cardiologist when you have a heart attack, you go see a neurologist when you have Alzheimer's, and the list goes on. What we have learned in the last, you know, 40 years, or in particular in the last 20 years, is that every one of these organs actually expresses quite, you know, a very shared number of pathways and molecules that regulate aging in every one of these tissues. Which means that when you, you know, if you have a heart attack today, you can probably go see a physician, and he's going to work on the risk factors that would prevent another heart attack. And we're very good at this. We can treat them, we can prevent them. However, when we do this, we do not really address the biggest underlying factor, which is your age. And so what the field of aging is doing is by identifying these shared pathways that are present in every single organ, once you target them, you actually are preventing not only the heart attack, but you're preventing neurodegeneration, you're modulating the rate of aging, which means you are working across the whole system. So not only is this approach preventative, but it's also global. And we see this in animal models. That is, when you tinker with the pathways that control aging, you change the rate of aging and you change the risk factor for all of these diseases together. So this is a concept that actually originated at the Buck, the so-called geroscience hypothesis, is this idea that aging as a risk factor trumps all other risk factors and should be the first one that we address. And so what's quite interesting is that this idea is meeting with, obviously, with a lot of resistance, because it is, in challenging a whole series of vested interests. I mean, modern medicine, of course, if you're a cardiologist, you are not interested in the doctor that tells you that the biggest risk factor is not the heart-specific factors, but, you know, these global things such as aging. And so I think we're quite excited to play this role and of disruptive force, and I think it has enormous potential for the future.
Was it challenging for you, having gone through like medical school and you said like jumping around institution to institution over the course of your career? It's like you said, you just mentioned the cardiologist, like it's a fairly traditional medical thinking and science that sort of overwhelms all of those different areas. And yet you sort of had the clarity to see past it and have this idea that, not that it was like your original idea or anything, but to sort of give credit and an open mind to this idea that we might be able to target aging as the risk factor, you know, the primary risk factor behind all of these diseases that are sort of aging induced. Was that challenging to sort of ignore probably a lot of what you had learned along the way and consider this concept that still sounds crazy to a lot of people, that we might be able to just hack at the root and go after aging directly?
Yeah, I love what your term, sort of hacking at the root. It is really what we're trying to do. Now, you know, some people have said it was, frankly, I mean, it was a very gradual process. So I do not remember sort of being challenged by it, because I was always extremely frustrated by what I saw as the shortcomings of modern medicine, the fact that there was so much suffering. The fact that, you know, if you are a normal person, you can be expected to spend 15% of your life afflicted by one of these chronic diseases of aging. So that always felt like a failure of the medical establishment. So I think, you know, when the geroscience hypothesis emerged, it was more like, wow, this is such an incredibly profound finding. But what was more challenging was the fact that when you discuss this with people, they will say, well, of course, you get old, you get sick. So we have accepted this as a sort of the norm. And is, you know, I've made some analogies to Newton. You know, Newton and his work on gravity, he was not the first one to observe that apples fell from trees. Everyone knew that apples fell from trees. And so the same way as everybody today knows that you get old, you get sick. So the question was that really distinguished Newton was the realization that of asking your question, why do apples fall from trees? And I think, you know, the role that we would love to play without, you know, too much hubris and comparing ourselves to Newton is the idea that, we want to answer the question, what is it about aging that actually predisposes you to all of these conditions? And can we understand aging at a molecular level such that we will actually really be able to slow it down, perhaps revert it, and actually really suppress these diseases of aging? And so the frustration for me right now has not been coming to this realization, it's been to the resistance that the traditional sort of medical world has given to us. And the fact that when we explain what we're trying to do, there is not, I think the excitement in my opinion, is not proportional to the potential of what we are trying to work on.
Right, so one of the things we talked about just briefly before starting the recording was the idea that there's this emerging class of wealthy people being minted, sort of in real time from crypto, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and all the rest. And it seems to me, you know, this is obviously a major interest of mine, and have a lot of people on the podcast from crypto in addition to longevity. And to me, there's a natural overlap there, where these younger people who tend to be more open-minded, and just frankly, like, dream a little bit more that we might be able to live till 200 or something that most people would have said was crazy. You know, most people still say it's crazy today, maybe. What do you think? I know you're sort of tangentially paying attention to some of the developments in crypto and excited about the potential of what that space can sort of do, maybe interlocking a little bit, intertwining with the growth and you know, study of aging. How do you think that relationship could play out over time, and sort of what's exciting to you there?
That's you make a really interesting point. You know, when I got into the field, I was under the impression that most people who were in the older days would actually be very interested in what we're doing, and this turns out not to be the case. It turns out that the people who appear to be the most excited about what we're doing are people who share sort of a philosophy of life. That we have, and that's the you know, and one of these communities is the crypto world. And I'm you know, just I guess perhaps by nature, I'm passioned by disruptive forces in nature and in society. And I think my impression is, without you know, talking about a domain that I do not know extremely well, is that the philosophy and the approaches of the crypto world and the aging world, aging research world, are very congruent and convergent. I think we are both quite new fields. You know, aging fields, aging research, the way we think about and the way we are practicing it is really a field that's mostly 20 to 25 years old. So it's relatively new. Crypto world is probably about 10 to 15 years old. We are both very disruptive forces in the way that our ambition is really to change the world and to make the world a better place. And I find it actually incredibly enlightening and inspiring for me to be working along, you know, aging people in the aging field, you know, the people who actually do the work. I've become more of a spokesman, even though I still have a lab. I give all the credit to the postdocs and the students who are doing the work in the labs. I mean, they're all in their 20s and they're passionate by their work. They're incredibly enthusiastic by their ability to change the world. And I see this, I see when, you know, perusing Twitter or, you know, talking to people who are in the crypto world, I feel exactly the same energy. And a friend, you know, quipped the expression that everybody young wants to be rich and everybody rich wants to be young. And I think there are many sort of a convergent interest between these two fields. And I'm really excited by the potential
Yeah, I mean,
of us working together to basically go to where we want to go, basically, which is to you know, healthier and longer lives.
I'm hopeful that that these things won't just sort of be progressing along in silos, but that there will be some overlap along the way. I know Vitalik, who created Ethereum, has already made some pretty substantial donations in the aging space, and there's just a lot of people, even going back to the very original days. One of the, I think, the first guy to do a transaction with the creator of Bitcoin, a guy named Hal Finney, was super into like cryo, and Roger Ver was also into that. He was one of the early people promoting Bitcoin, and he was on an early episode of the podcast, talked to them a bit about that. But there's just a sort of surprising amount of overlap. I couldn't really think of two very different and seemingly totally unrelated fields that seem to have sort of shared interests between a lot of people involved. So hopefully it continues to develop in that direction, and I'll certainly be doing my part, what little I can, to keep the two related and growing together to the extent that I can. I think from like a very fundamental perspective, it would be good to hear, given that you're running the book, how it fits into the overall sort of aging field right now and maybe historically or in the future. There's obviously like drug discovery and then clinical trials and bringing these things to whether they're drugs or supplements or products. There's a lot of different sort of stages of the science here. And it would be great to know like how, you know, where the buck fits into all of this, and how it helps lead the space forward. And maybe we could talk a little bit about what you specifically are most focused on.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, that's actually a great question. So maybe let me just tell you a little bit how we came to be, because I think it really speaks to some of the direction to where we are today. So we started in 1999 with a gift from Beryl Buck, who was a nurse, and whose husband, Mr. Buck, actually had a small amount of money, not so small at the time. It was $10 million, which eventually grew to a very large endowment. And they wanted to, in her testament, she said that she was leaving her personal fortune to create, to improve the life of the aged, and which was remarkably sort of a premonitory type of vision. At the time, people were not talking about aging research, and so came, you know, the buck to be. So we were funded with an endowment from the Buck family, which today contributes about 5 to 7% of our budget, which is, you know, not the whole budget, far from it, but a small part of it, and in her memory. And so what we have been doing for the past 20 years is essentially building a deeper understanding of the aging process. And about 20 years ago, as I mentioned, the first papers were emerging suggesting that aging could be a process like any other process biologically that you could modulate with small molecule, with drugs. And actually, the first drug to be shown to increase lifespan was reported by one of my colleagues here, Gordon Lithgow. And so this really opened up the whole field of thinking, well, maybe one day we will be able to modulate aging. And so much of our work until 5 years ago was focused on really mapping aging pathways, identifying possible drug targets. What was initially the exception, the first identification of a drug and a protein that could be regulating aging, just became actually quite easy to find. Today, we have more than 600 different drug targets for example, in C. elegans, a little worm that we work on, that can actually regulate aging. So just going from an exception, we've actually shown that it is not that difficult to regulate lifespan. And so did, you know, much work conducted in Drosophila and fruit flies and mice and so on. So we have gained an incomplete but certainly much better understanding of the aging process than what we had 20 years ago. I came to the Buck 5 years ago. I was at UCSF for 20 years before this, running a lab at the Gladstone Institute. And one of the reasons I think I was recruited to run the Buck is the fact that having a medical degree and an understanding of what it takes to, you know, to move research from model systems into humans, I think we've been embarked on a mission to really change medicine. And obviously, we are at the very beginning of what's going to be a long process, but an important one. And that is, you know, we can do a great job making mice live longer, making worms live longer. We can do amazing things in terms of our ability to regulate aging pathways. But you know, it's only going to become really significant to all of us the day we can implement these discoveries to humans. I mean, so the good news is we are now 5 years later, we've embarked and, you know, broadening our mission, recruiting MD PhDs, recruiting people who are interested in doing human biology, starting clinical trials, So everything is moving in the right direction. The thing that gives me pause is the fact that I want everyone to understand that this is much harder. As soon as you go into humans, there are, you know, a whole series of issues linked to safety, linked to you know, efficacy that need to be addressed. And so we are ready for the long haul, which is really the vision that we have, is to build a Beck Institute that will be the, you know, the world center for all things related to aging. Just a few statistics today, we have 300 employees, about 22 faculty members. Each of these faculty members has a group between 10 and 15 people. Everyone is working on aging. We all work on different aspects of the aging process. And, you know, based on the assumption that no one really has all the answers, and we are sort of hedging our bet by pursuing many different approaches that we think will be important in our effort to defeat aging. So it is a really exciting time, and I think one that I predict will lead to, you know, some of the first anti-aging medicine for humans within the next 5 to 10 years.
Right. So I sort of had one question I was going to ask based on what you were saying, and then that last question makes me want to ask another, or that last point rather. So I'll try to ask two, and hopefully you can touch a bit on both. The one that just came up at the end is, you said, you know, you're hoping that we'll see some real progress in the next 5 or 10 years, some early signs of some big breakthroughs. Be curious to know what you think is sort of most eligible to be that first or second breakthrough from where we are today. And then secondarily, maybe you can just answer that first. But the second thing I was wondering was, you know, you mentioned how all of this takes time and we're very early, and totally understand that. I wonder how much of it is sort of slowed or impeded by regulatory sort of, you know, traditional regulations and longstanding maybe risk-averse rules that we have in place, where in a perfect world, I'm wondering if there's anything that you might change to potentially, you know, open the door for accelerating some of these interesting technologies that we're working on today.
Boy, that's a big question. how much time do you have?
We got about 18 left on the scheduled block, but if you want to go over, I'm all ears.
Yeah. So, first question I'll address is the whole issue of what are the, what do I think this field is going in terms of translation in the next few years? Is that a good way to rephrase what you said?
Yeah.
So I think, I suspect, you know, your audience is probably interested in the field of aging. So they've heard about many of the targets that I will be discussing briefly. One thing that I would like for your listeners to realize is that one of the biggest limitations that we have right now is not a dearth of ideas and potential therapies. It's the fact that we don't have the funding to go after all of them at once. And so people are essentially trying to hedge their bets and try to see to go after the ones that seem to be the most promising. However, as we know, getting medicine approved for humans is a long and arduous process. So we have to be proceeding cautiously. So there is, I mean, clearly a need for more funding for people to jump on this adventure and help us to really explore not one target, but multiple targets. That being said, if you look at the field, there are a number of these targets that are ready in humans, and some of them are tested in humans. I will think about, you know, a drug like metformin, which is an anti-diabetic drug. This rapamycin has been shown to increase lifespan. It is very promising. But again, here we also need to do careful clinical trials. Now, when I speak about clinical trials, this will touch upon the whole issue of regulatory that you mentioned. The difficulty of testing drugs in the aging space, obviously, is nobody can afford to do a 30 or 40 year clinical trial to see, you know, who dies when. So the field is taking a number of approaches that are going to be quite interesting in terms of how to address this. One way is to target a specific disease of aging and see if you can modulate it. Another way is to actually identify novel biomarkers that correlate with aging. And this is a big field of research right now, really trying, imagine the field of heart attacks and statins without the ability to measure cholesterol. We know that once we were able to measure cholesterol levels and to determine that they represented a significant risk factor for heart disease, this created a whole industry, $20 billion a year statin industry, that actually now mitigates the risk of a heart attack. So imagine when we will have a validated biomarker of aging. I think we could really, this would be one of the tools that will drive the revolution that we think is before us. So I've mentioned sort of metformin, rapamycin, a whole field that is very exciting for us here at the BAC. Also is the whole idea of senescence and senolytics. So these are drugs that selectively kill senescent cells. We know that they accumulate during aging. We know they play an important role in the number of chronic disease of aging. Julie Campisi, who is a faculty member at the BAC, has been a pioneer in defining the whole senescence field. And including the founding of Unity, a company that generated the first senolytics. And so these are in clinical trials, and we hope that, you know, within the next few years, hopefully one of those will be efficient at combating one of these chronic diseases of aging. But there are so many other areas in the field. I'll speak briefly about epigenetic reprogramming, which is a field very dear to me, having worked on epigenetics for the last 30 years. And having identified and cloned many of the genes that actually are epigenetic regulators, I can definitely tell the enormous potential that this has. This is, by the way, one of the first interventions that has been shown to lead to a reversal of the aging process. It's still modest results, but they really carry a potential for big things in the future. And so epigenetic reprogramming is certainly one of the most exciting area in the aging research right now. But others I'll speak of, you probably have heard about heterochronic parabiosis. This is the idea that you can that there are factors circulating in the blood that might be contributing to aging. And so, you know, two different approaches there. One is to identify these factors that are present in young people and give them to older individuals, hoping to rejuvenate them. The other approach is to actually try to dilute the bad factors that accumulate during aging. And so both approaches are being explored and I think could also yield interesting drugs in the future. So that would be, you know, sort of a very broad survey. I'm sure I'm going to insult some colleague because I haven't mentioned the area that they're working on. You know, autophagy regulation is another big area. Fasting, and the list goes on. There are so many, and not to say anything about exercise or, you know, mimicking exercise with medicine. All of these are areas that are being explored in the field. From a regulatory standpoint, I tend to be a bit on the conservative point of view because I think having seen, you know, over the years, the number of drugs that actually have hurt people, really inspires some degree of caution. I think we have to be willing to take chances, but we also have to be careful and cognizant of the fact that whenever you give a drug to someone, you have a potential to improve them, but you also have the potential to hurt them. And I have argued that, you know, the field of research is so young, it cannot afford or it can ill afford for some really bad story to emerge in the literature that we've actually hurt some young people and cut it and decrease their lifespan by 10 to 20 years. And, you know, one reason I'm saying this is that if you think about a drug that's going to be used in younger individual with the hope of increasing a lifespan, we're speaking potentially of interventions that are going to last a lifespan. And so one way to maybe mitigate this is to think, let's start this in people who are, you know, later in life, who might already be suffering for some of the manifestations of aging, and see if we can actually see an effect there. So there are multiple ways in which the field is grappling with how we're going to be deploying these drugs that have the potential to fight aging. On the other hand, I think, you know, many of us are, I call ourselves free agents. And for example, the fact that people are taking metformin now is a good reflection of this. The same thing can be said for a whole group of middle-aged or younger people who are also taking rapamycin. I would say as long as people understand what the risks are and what the limitations, that is totally fine. But at the end of the day, the only way that these therapies will become not only deployed, but also reimbursed and broadly available is through the rigor of the clinical trials, a placebo-controlled clinical trial, which is the only way you can actually really determine whether something works or not. And I think as a field, I would argue that we should be adventurous, but we should also submit ourselves to the most rigorous ways of demonstrating the efficacy of what we're doing. And there are, you know, a number of things that are circulating around in the field that are making promises. And I would invite all of your listeners to, you know, to watch all of this with a suspicious, not suspicious, but a questioning eye, because until it is proven, it is not proven. And which means that we have a lot of work to do, and we will do the work. One thing to realize also is the way biology is accelerating, I think gives me hope that what we consider as limitations today, for example, this idea of having to do a 10-year clinical trial to demonstrate the efficacy of one of our drugs, these barriers are going to be falling. We will identify better biomarkers, and hopefully within 2 or 3 years, we will be able to predict with a reasonable degree of certainty whether a drug is going to work or not. And I think this is, for me, the whole field of biomarkers of aging is a huge area of potential to, it's not only the potential, but it's also the brake right now that slows down the field, really to allow us to accelerate what we're doing and translate all these discoveries for humans.
Yeah, I think the discovery and development of accurate and reliable biomarkers has always struck me as something that would be a huge catalyst to just accelerate progress, given that, you know, an aging study, you typically have to wait to watch people age. But if you could kind of find a biomarker similarly, like to how you mentioned earlier with like cholesterol and things like this, then it might just allow people to do shorter time intervals on clinical trials and things like this, and hopefully help to accelerate progress in the space. Last question for you. I know I'd heard on a previous podcast, you talked about how some of these technologies that are available and frankly pretty easy and quick from my understanding to use today, such as like CRISPR and Cas9, things like this. You had said that earlier in your career, if someone had told you that these things would be available and practicable and as easy as they are today and as commonplace, you basically wouldn't have believed them. And I know you're a relatively conservative guy working in a very ambitious space, so it's sort of like an oxymoron in a sense, but I think it's like the right level of conservatism. So I'd love to hear, given sort of who you are and the space that you're in, what's at like the edge of your imagination today for what we could see like within your lifetime, or call it, you know, in the next 20 to 50 years, whatever sort of timeline you want to put on it. I'm not suggesting that that's your lifetime, but just in the next like reasonable few decades, what's like sitting at the edge of your imagination? It's obviously an unfair question to ask you, you know, what unbelievable thing lies ahead, because sort of by nature, you wouldn't believe it. But I'm curious to hear some of sort of the edge cases from a conservative person such as yourself.
Well, first, I would not call myself conservative. I really, I if you knew me, and you would probably call me anything but conservative. I want to change the world. I think it's really the thing that gets me up every morning, and I'm really willing to disrupt. I mean, being an MD and taking this stance is not conservative. It is actually highly disruptive. However, I also want to be a realist, and I think, you know, there is a need of there's a need in every field for someone to just project extremely far and to see what could be. There's also a need for a voice of realism. It is hard to develop drugs. It takes long time. It is expensive. And we want to do it well. To me, that's really the most important thing. We want to do good. The goal here for me is not to, you know, to create a drug that's going to make a lot of money, but not really change people's lives. And so my approach in everything, and I think this is an approach that I've argued our field should take, is to we're in this for the long haul. And so my approach is to underpromise and overdeliver, hopefully. And I suspect that this is exactly what will happen from our standpoint. So I'm very reluctant, for example, to talk about how many years are we going to live. And I get invited on post podcast, and it's either 120 or 150 or 200. And you know, my answer to these numbers is there is no one today. Not me, not David Sinclair, not anybody who actually can predict how long we're going to be living in the future. What I can tell you is biology is moving at a rate that really suggests that we will accelerate the process of increasing our lifespan, and possibly even within my own lifespan. You know, there's someone recently told me that the human brain is, as when you look about exponential processes, tends to overestimate the short-term effect of exponential processes and underestimate the long-term effect of these exponential processes. Now, one big question is, for example, is research on aging already an exponential process? I would say that biology in general is undergoing an acceleration. The likes of which I, you know, haven't been in the field for close to 35 years, I have never seen before. The acceleration of our understanding, the acceleration and the complexity of the new tools, bringing in AI and bioinformatics, we are generating so much data and so much more understanding than what we used to do. It's absolutely exhilarating of excitement. And so, you know, I think a number of people tend to overestimate how quickly this is going to translate into humans. But again, I suspect that we are all underestimating the dramatic effect it's going to have, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50, or 100 years from now. And so I'm totally bullish on what we're going to be able to accomplish. You know, it's again, you know, the last sentence is, I think it was Niels Bohr, the famous physicist, who said it's very hard to make prediction, especially about the future. And I think this is probably where I stand right now. I think I know I'm going to be busy for a lifetime, continuing to work on this incredibly exciting biology, pushing this as hard as we can into humans. And hopefully we'll have some victories along the way. But I think the future is just incredibly bright for all of us.
That's awesome. I love that answer. I hope you're working on these things for a very long lifetime, and I'm excited to follow along as you go. Wrapping up here, we're up on time, but where can people go and follow along all of this progress, and maybe where can they go to donate to Buck if they want to, and things like this. And before we end with that, just want to thank you again, Eric. It was awesome talking with you, and really love and you know admire what you guys are doing, and we'll be rooting for you for as long as I'm alive. Hopefully you guys help that to be a very long time.
Thank you so much. And come to visit when you have a chance. I think in terms of places where you can follow us, we are it's buckinstitute.org is our website. I think we've tried to build it to appeal both to this general public, but also to what I call highly educated amateurs or people who are scientists. So hopefully everyone will find something of interest there at the website. We're also reopening for business. We have, and hopefully in the near future, we will have more, if you live in the Bay Area, we will have more seminars and some of them on Zoom. And finally, I try to be a little bit active on Twitter, and you can follow me on at Eric Verdin and with a C, Verdin. And if you're interested in helping us out, just send me a message. I'm at, again, everdin@buckinstitute.org. And thank you for the opportunity, and I think look forward to staying in touch.